Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
I'm joined by singer-songwriter, Eurovision winner indeed, Charlie McGettigan. How are you, Charlie?
Morning, Brendan. Lovely to be here.
Charlie, as a musician, was it an impossible job to pick just five songs that meant the most to you?
Well, as I said to my wife this morning, if it had been today, I would have picked five different ones. It all depends on the mood you're in and certain things govern what... Because there's so much music out there. My life has been sort of music since I was about 7 years of age, you know. We were very lucky. I grew up in Donegal. At that time, Radio Éireann didn't sort of play any pop music or any kind of popular music. It was mostly traditional Irish music or orchestral music, classical music. But we had the BBC Light programme. And so we used to hear The Goons and Mrs. Dale's Diary and family favourites and all those things. So you would hear popular music. And one of the first pieces of music I picked it because it was constantly on the radio around 19.
So just give us a year now,
About 57, 1957. Okay, yeah.
That's, no, you so know what was going on then? Rock and roll was kind of coming on the scene a bit, wasn't
you'd hear it? You'd hear it on a station called AFN, the American Forces Network.
Yeah.
And if you were lucky enough, you'd have to dial your thing in very, very carefully. And you'd hear all these American singers. I suppose people would have heard Elvis there first, the Everly Brothers, Gene Vincent, all these different people. And
was there a gramophone in the house then?
No,
or anything
we didn't have
like
a gramophone.
That? The wireless was the window on the world of music. Was
64,
it?
I got our first, it was a dance set record player.
Oh, yeah.
You could put two or three things on it and they dropped down and you could play them over one of them. My father bought it because he wanted to play Jim Reeves records all the time. And I hated Jim Reeves. So when I bought Spencer Davis's group, Saw You Running, he was horrified that I was going to play this on his record player.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, we were very lucky in getting all those BBC programmes because in those days, I often say to people, a programme like this now, for example, if there was music, it was live music. They'd have an orchestra, maybe 20 pieces of people playing live music and all the little sound effects and interjections, the little stings, what we call them now, they would all have been played live, you know, and an audience possibly in there as well.
It's an elaborate setup back then. Your first choice. Is a Perry Como song?
Yeah, and the reason I picked it was I used to hear it on the radio, and my dad was setting up a public address system in the local horse show that was happening. I didn't know what a public address system or a microphone or what anything was, but he was testing it out, and he said, "Charlie, get up and stand in front of that long steel pole with a ball on the top of it." And he said, "Give us an old song." And I didn't know there was a microphone, so I sang "Catch a Falling Star." And I heard my voice going all through the tannoy speakers, all through the arena. And I said, "I love this. I want to do this," you know. And that was the reason I picked it, because it's always, and I still sing it sometimes in my gig, just as a sort of a novelty piece, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of a corny song. Yeah. I think the idea of "Catch a Falling Star," as a kid, you just saw stars were in the sky and you figured they were that size.
Yeah.
And you know, the idea of catching it and put it in your pocket. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Wouldn't it be just lovely?
Yeah, and he does evoke a certain era. Okay, here's Perry Como, "Catch a Falling Star."
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. Just in case you feel you wanna hold her, you'll have a pocket full of starlight. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away.
Never let it fade away.
Catch a falling star and put it.
Okay, that's Charlie McGettigan's first choice, Perry Como, "Catch a Falling Star." And we're both listening to it there, as you said, corny as hell. It is like, so that was just at the tail end of the old era of when music kind of vanilla and kind of innocent and everything.
Before rock and roll.
And then, so rock and roll kind of came into your dad bought you an electric guitar, did he?
He did. I was 12 at that stage.
Yeah.
And I had been listening from about the age of 10 till 12 to stations like Radio Lux Luxembourg, where they would play all this American rock and roll music, and we'd hear it, and indeed British pop music as well, Cliff Richard and the Shadows, Adam Faith, and all those, you know, Hank Marvin and all those people, and I was extremely interested in.
And was this all very exotic?
Of course it was, because television was starting to come in then as well, so you were seeing programs like Thank Your Lucky Stars and Discs A Go Go, where all these people came on and they mimed on things, but. It was brilliant because in those days you emulated your stars. Even if you look back, most people, you didn't go for a haircut in those days, you went for an oil change. You know, it was Brill Cream was the order of the day, and everybody had a comb. So you always had to keep your hair in order.
Right.
And then suddenly in 1962, the whole thing changed when the Beatles came along. Love Me Do by the Beatles. I was 12 at the time. Can you imagine the hearing that for the first time when you're 12 years of age?
Did it change everything?
Everything changed. And not just musically, but the whole way the world dressed, you know, the way the world was. Eventually, it began to affect social mores and stuff, and the way people spent their lives, because like John Lennon, the peace movement, you know, and that. But this is 1962, and suddenly here's these four mop tops who combed their hair the other way down. It was combed down. They had a fringe in the front. And suddenly everybody, poor old barbers, were going out of business, right, left and centre, because you only went to haircut then maybe once every 3 months, whereas before that would be once a week.
So because if you weren't there to see them come the first time, it's hard to imagine what the impact must have been like. But had you seen nothing like them before? No?
Well, it was rock and roll before that. It was Elvis Presley. It was, you know, the Everly Brothers, all that. Which was great, don't get me wrong. But suddenly these guys, they were cheeky. They were, you know, they didn't conform to any kind of normality at all. They went completely different. And they were very funny. You know, there's some great interviews online. I mean, Frank Hall, I remember listening to Frank Hall I remember his programme on the telly, interviewing the Beatles. There's videos of Jay Byrne, and they were just literally and they were shocked. People were shocked. But the funny thing about the Beatles was their music immediately was very infectious. And I think the fact that they did a few standards in their set means that parents liked them as well. So, you know.
Okay, so they're kind of a bridge from skiffle and that kind of thing.
It's hard to describe it, but it was fantastic. And they progressed from She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, to, you know, Sergeant Pepper's, you know.
And it all happened much more quickly than we think, looking back. The whole arc was what?
They moved very quickly over a period of about 5 or 6 years. Yeah. Up till about 68, 69, they began to come apart and split up and stuff like that. But the progress their music made, from quite banal songs to really wonderful songs. And I've picked a song that I think it has to be one of my favourite songs. I would have picked this no matter what day you asked me, because it's got everything a song needs. It's got wonderful melody, very interesting lyrics, the changes, all the different. There's got a thing, there's a soprano trumpet. Now, a soprano trumpet, you know what a trumpet sounds like. This is another octave above that, and this soprano trumpet solo comes in the middle of it. And this was the dawning of the new Beatles, I think, really.
Okay.
And this single came out, and it's one called Penny Lane.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a bank over the motor car, the little children laughing at him behind his back. Pouring rain.
Very good. We held on for the trumpet there. Mm. Charlie was talking me through every movement there. See this bit here, that bit there, and everything else. But you're right, extraordinary. And kind of the music hall thing from Paul in there as well, a bit. See, like, you know, they did take loads of strands of everything. And
his dad was a trumpet player, and his dad had a little band called James McCartney's Little Jazz Band that right. played. And he used to play the piano. And the Beatles, a bit like the Irish in a way, in Liverpool. A Liverpool thing was family get-togethers would mean you would have to get up and do your turn and sing your song and do whatever you do. McCartney, literally when his dad got arthritis, McCartney learned to play the piano himself. Never had a lesson, but just literally followed it through.
Yeah, we could talk about the Beatles all day, I know, because you're immersed in their
totally.
Lore. Well, yeah, everyone has their one band, and the Beatles are yours. You read all
never
the books.
Never a day goes by, Brendan, that
really?
I don't think of the Beatles.
Still, yeah.
It's really, that's ridiculous, but that's the way it is.
Yeah. So then you started getting into bands as a teenager then, yeah?
Yeah, well, when Dad bought me the guitar, I remember he bought it from a Walker's catalogue. And in my innocence, Christmas morning came, and my innocence, I thought you just plugged it into the wall. I didn't realise you had to have an amplifier and all that kind of stuff. And, and I got around it because in those days, we had all wooden floors and I was a wooden frame bed. So I used to stick it up against the bed. And when I play a chord, the whole room would be a sound thing for it. But he bought me this. And of course, in a small town like Ballyshannon, where I was growing up, it's hard to believe there were three rock bands in Ballyshannon. The population is 2,000 people and two Cayley bands, you know.
Yeah.
So going home from school, I met this fellow, John Hannigan, a friend of mine, and for years since, we're still friends. And he said, I have a guitar and you have a guitar. Why don't we get together? And eventually we had a little band together. And there was a great band in the town called The Erratics, who they were very clever, because an erratic geologically is a rolling stone.
All right.
So this is where they got the name. And there was another band called Federal Aviation. What a great name, you know. And we were called the Rainbows, very bland. Yeah. But we had decided we'd have a three-band session in Bundoran around Easter time, 1965, 66, around that time. And we thought we were the bee's knees, and we were strutting our stuff and playing our riffs and all that kind of stuff. And the next thing, I saw this tousle-haired, red-haired, ginger-haired fella from the side of the stage who come on with an electric Fender Mustang guitar, which is the next thing down from his Telecaster or Stratocaster.
Yeah.
I said, who the hell is this? And this guy started to play, and he opened up with an Elvis song called One Night With You was the name. I'll never forget it. And it was Paul Brady. And we literally, our jaws just dropped. We put away our guitars and that's it.
What look. Was it about him?
Hmm? He had, I think he still has always had a unique voice. You know, that you will always know his voice. And it's strident, it's soulful. He puts everything into a song. You know, he doesn't hold back. You know, and I've been an admirer of his ever since. And I got to know him then, back in the 1960s, and I kept running into each other as people do in this world. I'd read his book last year, and he talks a little bit about that. But he talks about a period. He was a star in my mind, and I figured he was success.
Mm.
And I remember he joined a band called the Johnstons, and they were making really good music. And they ended up going to America and touring over there. But it wasn't until I read the book that it wasn't all plain sailing, that at one point in time he was on the point of busking in America because he had literally no money. He couldn't even afford the money to send a parcel home. And the book is fantastic from that point of view, because my image of him was this star in lights. And the book sort of says, no, it wasn't quite like that.
But and of course, he became a fantastic songwriter as well. So many people did his songs, Tina Turner and the rest.
Yeah.
But you picked him singing this is a Hank Williams song.
Yeah, I think he's a great interpreter of songs as well, you know. And this one is a particularly good interpretation of Hank Williams, You Win Again. It's just absolutely wonderful.
Okay, let's have a listen.
Was my great sin
practically yodeling there. Fantastic. Yeah.
But he
and he's it's squaring the circle as well in a way, isn't it?
Coming
because
back
if you
to
think
it,
that, yeah, that, yeah, that you can see there the connection between
what he is
our
now,
music
yeah,
and,
what he became.
No, but country music yeah. and Irish music, yeah, like yeah. That whole thing. Yeah.
He was playing in Mundoran at the time on a on the pub circuit in a place called the Holyrood Hotel in Mundoran, and Brian McNiff, the famous Donegal football manager who won the All Ireland with Donegal back in 1982, I think, or 92. But he was just, and he'd come up to our, we'd all go to different pubs and we'd all play together, and you know, people drifted from one pub to another, where if somebody was there, oh, we'd go up and Paul would arrive up and he'd yeah. sing some songs with us and we'd go down there, and it was just a wonderful time in Bundoran at that time. And then suddenly in 1969, the whole thing changed when the Northern Troubles started. Suddenly people didn't want to hear You Win Again, and they didn't want to hear Catch a Falling Star. They wanted to hear rebel songs, and I literally couldn't live with that. I remember going back down, and the pub that I used to play in, and he rang me and said, "Will you come out and play a few songs?" And I went out, and literally it was a completely different audience. It was suddenly split down the middle. And we used to sing, believe it or not, before that, we used to sing the Sash My Father Wore in the pub, and everybody would join in. You know what I think? You know? And I didn't see it as any kind of, I just thought it was a great song.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But suddenly you wouldn't even mention the word, because the Troubles had come along.
Okay, so you gravitated down to Dublin, but then ultimately to Leitrim, you kept a steady job as well all the time. You didn't run off to join the circus at that stage.
No. Funny talking about the circus. My little granddaughter Olivia, she's out there listening, and thanks a million to everybody for allowing her to come and observe what goes on in a radio program. But she was at her first circus last week. And I was a huge fan of the circus as well. The circus came to town one day a year, and it was fantastic. What have we been talking about circuses for?
Yeah, going back to, but you had a steady job in the,
yeah.
in the ESB.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
And the music on the side then.
On the side, I would be playing in Kerry and Cork and all over the place. And I remember getting the ferry, many weekends, getting the ferry over from Tralee over to the, and driving up and getting in time for work at 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, but
yeah.
you see, we had energy then.
Yeah.
You know, you know, when you were young, and I still have the. I wish I had the energy, but I'm still as committed to music as I ever was. It was just something, and I worked with a singer called Maura O'Connell for a couple of years. And Maura was, again, very much like Paul Brady. And it's funny, Paul Brady and Maura are very good friends. Maura was totally committed. When she sang a song, she was committed to it. And you know, to stand beside her on the stage, and with the two of us went out as a duo for a couple of years. And we often played, I remember we were one particular gig down in Kerry, in Ballybunion, and we played at a roller disco. Kids on roller skates running around, and we're yeah. singing our songs up there, you know. So
and still she was completely committed, whatever.
It was like as if she didn't even know they were there.
Yeah, isn't that the difference between yeah. the good and the great? Like
oh,
that
yeah.
100% commitment.
Absolutely.
And of course, people remember Feet of a Dancer.
I call that the pension.
Yeah.
And the day Maura was poking through a bunch of songs of mine, and she said, "What does that one go like?" I can remember it as clearly. And I couldn't remember it myself. It was that, you know, I had to say, oh, yeah, yeah. And she recorded it, and it's literally been recorded by loads of people since.
And
I've picked a different song for
yeah.
Maura. She did an album. She was friendly with a man called Béla Fleck, who was one of the world's top five-string banjo players. And through him, she got to meet Jerry Douglas, who's the world's class dobro player, the best in the world. She, by these connections, she met the top musicians in Nashville, really the creme de la creme of musicians. And she made a record which Jerry Douglas produced. And going back to the Beatles, she picked a Beatles song in this particular one. It's one of my favourite Beatles songs from the Revolver album. But Maura, again, you will hear, she makes it her own. And particularly, listen, I hate to ask you to wait till they hear the dobro solo on this.
Yeah. Okay, all right, so this is for no one, Maura O'Connell.
The day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up, she takes her time, she doesn't feel she has to hurry, she no longer needs you. And in her eyes you'll see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears, cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think
So that was the dobler there. Is that the flat string guitar?
Yeah,
kind of
you
thing,
play
yeah?
it on your lap.
Yeah, yeah,
rather
yeah.
than play it like a normal guitar, and it's people call it Hawaiian guitar, but Jerry Douglas is the master of it.
Oh yeah, and so it's a, and there's this that slide element.
Yeah, slide,
it.
Slide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. So that was Maura O'Connell for No One. That was Charlie McGettigan's fourth choice. I'd have to ask you about the Eurovision. Is it a high point in your life?
Well, we were very lucky, Paul Harrington and myself, in that we found a song that suited us. Just it was like putting on a tailor-made suit. It was so easy for us to sing it. And people often ask me, "Were you nervous?" It was something like 100 million people tuned in.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in the least. I'd be more nervous playing in a pub on a Saturday night.
Really?
Than I was, yeah. Because we were, the two of us, we never played it the same way twice. You know, there was always a little subtle, and Paul would catch my, even on the night, he'd look up, you heard that little thing I put in there. You know, this would be all in your head. Because it's a beautiful song, and it's quite a serious song. It's about a married couple who are, they're past their prime. And they're trying to look back and say, God, I wish I was back when we were going to Fats Domino concerts and we were going out and having fun and stuff like that. You know, I wish I could go back to then because we were the rock and roll kids back then, you know, and it's quite a serious song. But it's a song that everybody knows. You know, I still sing it after 30 years. I still sing it at every gig. And I could literally just play the guitar and the audience would sing it themselves, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, everybody says it was at the pinnacle of success. Yes, it was great, but the real, I knew when I was successful when Maura O'Connell recorded Feet of a Dancer, when I heard that first, I said...
Really, yeah.
Oh, that was, you know, you can imagine what it's like, such a compliment for somebody like Maura to record your song, you know?
Yeah. Listen, before we finish up, can I ask you about Shane?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I suppose I think sometimes music can be a great consolation to escape into, and, you know, it can be balm for the soul and everything. So your son, Shane, died.
He died on a building site in Boston where the scaffolding he was standing on collapsed and he fell down 12 stories and sadly we lost him.
Yeah.
But
did you get over it?
You never get over it. It's there, always there. But I say to people, I have it in, you know, you've just opened the box. I have it in a little box in my head.
Yeah.
And whenever I want to open the box, I open it up and we talk and we still talk. We have pictures of him all over the place and stuff like that. Because he was almost, my memories are all great. I have no bad memories.
Yeah.
He played for our local club, Alan Gales. He played for St. Mel's in Longford. He played for Leitrim, you know. And I remember the last conversation I had with him, he was heading off. Somebody from Boston said, I wonder would he come over for the summer and play some football for our club, and with a cat, drink milk. Of course, he went like a shot, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember we were at a match in Tuam, and the last conversation I had with him, look at whatever you do, enjoy it, go on and have fun. And then, sadly, you know, we were sitting watching the telly one night on a Tuesday night, I'll never forget it, and the door, there was these three, a combination of three people out there. I said, I don't normally see these people together. And
that's a desperate shock, yeah. But there is joy in life.
Oh, and memories of them.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. And listen, your final choice. Now, this is a bit of a nepo grandchild kind of situation here, but your grandchildren are continuing the musical tradition. So your grandson, Porrick Barrett, is a musician.
Bennett, I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Porrick Bennett is he's my first grandchild. And I can remember pushing him around in the pram up and around Drumshambo where I live and bobbing him up and down on my knee, you know, and saying, gang, gang, gooly, gooly, watch. But we had to stop it, though. His friends were getting a little bit embarrassed. 14 at the time, you know. But, he started learn the violin at 7. Then he became very much involved in classical music. He played with the Dublin Youth Orchestra. And right up till I lent him a guitar. I've never got it back. And he's still playing it. And he started writing songs. And, you know, I'm learning from him now, Brendan. You know, he is so accomplished. He's going to the Royal Irish Academy in his second year there. He's conducting orchestras and conducting choirs and the devil and all. But he's writing songs and recording as well. And this song that I picked was recorded in a tiny little studio about 6 foot by 6 foot in Drumshambo.
Okay.
And it's world class song, you know, and it's called Grey.
Okay, so look, Charlie, your band Jargon are at the Cornmill Theatre in Carrigallen in Leitrim on Sunday, December 10th, is that right? So we'll mention that. Charlie McGettigan, thank you so much. And we'll leave them now with, this is so Pádraig, Bennett and Gray.
Now Susie's eyes are green, heavy and wise with all the things she's seen. So tell me, how does a gal so young get caught by the devil's tongue? And Joey's eyes are blue. If you saw him, you'd see he's honest and true. But if you add up all his vices, you'll see how they paid their prices. So why are my eyes so gray? Have all my dreams wasted away in that old ashtray? I've got so many things to do and so many places to stay. So why, oh why, oh why have my eyes gone grey?
Email brendan@rte.ie.